And you are listening to Radio Regent. My name is Norman Richmond, and joining me on the line is Isaac Sadie. Are you there?
I'm there, Norman. Thank you again for having me on your program. It's been a while, but it's always a pleasure.
All right. I wanted to say that you are the author of Cuba, A Revolution in Motion, and you are working at Dalhousie University in Halifax. And I guess for full disclosure, we have known one another for quite a few years, and we both have a lot of things in common politically, but I guess that'll come out when we finish this interview. But what I wanted to begin with is that you are living in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and you yourself are Trinidadian.
Yep, and I grew up in Trinidad and Tobago. I also have roots in the black community here in Nova Scotia as well.
Mm-hmm. But what I wanted to ask you is that Halifax, Nova Scotia was the first place that Malcolm X's mother came to. She came to Halifax from La Digue, Grenada, and then she migrated to Montreal. But what I really wanted to ask you about was H. Sylvester Williams, who is the father of Pan-Africanism, and he also has something to do with hockey.
Yeah.
He was a Trinidadian who lived in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I really wanted to just give us some before we start this interview about Cuba. What's the situation with H. Sylvester Williams, and is he that well known in the Halifax community?
No, he's not that well known, unfortunately, right? And in fact, this is one of the major issues, because one of the things that people have been concerned about, I mean, there is, for example, mention of him, for example, in the the formation of various other social activities, right? Or organizations, particularly the one you mentioned, the sporting one in Nova Scotia and so forth. What's interesting about Sylvester Williams is that he was at Dalhousie University, and he was at the time, his time would have coincided with the time that James Robinson Johnson was here. James Robinson was attending Dalhousie University. James Robinson Johnson, as some of your listeners may know, is the first black lawyer to graduate from Dalhousie University. He became a very important person in the black Nova Scotian community, very active politically and so forth. So, even though it stands to reason that, two brothers at a university such as Dalhousie back in the 1890s, right, obviously would have interacted in some way and had some sort of political discussion, right? And so it would have been, but we don't know exactly what the content, or at least we haven't uncovered, or I'm not aware yet, as anybody's actually done their work, on what was the kind of interaction between James Robinson Johnson and Henry Sylvester Williams, And Henry Sylvester Williams has been very important in calling organizing the 1900 conference on Pan-Africanism and so forth, which becomes so very important to the international black struggle. So we know very little about Henry Sylvester Williams here. It's one of these areas of research or areas that needs to be excavated and explored more. There's so many aspects of the black Nova Scotian history and the African-Canadian experience that need to be explored more. And sometimes you get these sort of very teasing tidbits that Henry Sylvester Williams is here. We know a little bit about him. Obviously, there's evidence he must have been active socially in the community, but because he was a political person, it's clear he would have also been engaged in some political activity, at least discussions. But we haven't yet done that research. And I think this is an area that really is so tempting and titillating to so many of us to carry on this kind of research. I mean, what's interesting, to take this a little broader, is that the Black Canadian Studies Conference just finished up at Brock just a few weeks ago called Where Are You From? The Black Presence in Canada. And it was extremely well attended, especially by young scholars, right? There's a lot of young people who are doing this kind of research and so forth. And what came out in those discussions, similar to the kind of points I'm raising on Henry Sylvester Williams, is there's so much more to research. There's so many nuances. There's so many threads, right, and tributaries that exist in the Black Canadian history that we need to explore these things and so on. So what's interesting is that around Henry Sylvester Williams, he's very little known in the black community here. And so forth. And some people are now drawing out the kind of links that exist between the Caribbean, for example, and Nova Scotia. You know, some of your readers may also know that Marcus Garvey visited Nova Scotia at least on two occasions in the 20s and also in the 30s. And in fact, one of the speeches he gave in Nova Scotia was actually the foundation for the lyrics of Redemption Song, Bob Marley's Redemption Song and so forth. You know, people who've read, for example, Bobby Hill's work on Marcus Garvey and so forth will be aware of this. So there's been this international connection of the black Nova Scotian community to the black world, so to speak, right, to the cause of Pan-Africanism, to the African diaspora that needs to be teased out quite a bit more and so forth. And Henry Sylvester Williams is one of these most interesting, fascinating, and, of course, evocative aspects of this link and so forth. So I wish I could say more concretely about what he was doing, but it's clear that he would have obviously been who he was, been interacting with people like James Robinson Johnson, and of course clearly been involved in these social activities and sporting activities. He would have actively been involved in the black community, and it would be interesting to know what his thoughts were and so on.
Well, I don't want to spend that much. We're going to be talking about Cuba, but it's my understanding that hockey started in A lot of hockey began in Nova Scotia. I don't know if the native people, but some of the first hockey leagues came out of Nova Scotia and were actually black teams, and that it's my understanding that H. Sylvester Williams was involved in that particular activity.
Yeah, he was involved in hockey, and in fact, it's actually mentioned in a plaque at the Black Cultural Center.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's an argument that hockey actually was invented in Nova Scotia, so there's
right.
all these debates, where was hockey invented and so forth, right?
Right.
So it's clear, you know, he was definitely clearly involved in the community. What I'm interested in is someone who is, you know, considered the father of Pan-Africanism, right, who clearly was a political person, who clearly was interested in the fact that people of African descent, right, shared a fundamental commonality wherever they were, on which side of the Atlantic, whether they were situated on this side or that side of the Atlantic, is, you know, that was his position. And what the political Sylvester Williams, what he did in Nova Scotia is little researched and so forth, right? And it's clear that, you know, obviously he was involved in the community, he was involved in the hockey league, and I'm pretty sure there must have been some political discussions, particularly if he was a contemporary at Dalhousie University of James Robinson Johnson, who was very political in the community. And I'm sure the evidence exists. It just requires somebody to have the interest in researching it,
to do it.
Going through the documents and so forth that may exist in people's houses and so forth, and also having the resources and so forth. But it shows that even though the black population in Nova Scotia is relatively small compared to the population in Toronto, it shows how rich, textured, and surprising this history is. And that's why we need to really further excavate and explore it and so forth. And that's one of the things that some of us and some other scholars here attempt to do, to draw out these threads that run parallel to the to the other aspects of the tapestry, like the black royalists, the black refugees and the Maroons, that people may be more familiar with, but there's all this other interesting stuff that's going on that demonstrates how strong the objective and often the subjective connections that exist between communities of people of African descent across the Atlantic, across the world, how strong these connections are.
Well, let me say this, and then we're going to go into the interview, but Snoop Lion, formerly Snoop Doggy Dog, formerly Snoop Dogg, formerly Calvin Buckstress, I think his name, he was born. The first time he came on TV, I saw him on the Arsenio Hall show, and he had on a Toronto Maple Leaf jersey, and he's a big hockey man. But let's deal with Cuba now. Cuba, A Revolution in Motion, your book, has I recommend everyone get that particular book. It's Fernwood Press out of Nova Scotia. But the first question I want to ask you is that recently there was a talk in a discussion between community people, yourself and Dr. Keith Ellis, about the question of race in Cuba. And the whole question of race in Cuba, and you know, there some people have argued that Cuba had a socialist revolution, and racism is a thing of the past. Whereas many people have said that racism exists, including Fidel Castro himself has said that. Could you talk about the question of race in Cuba in 2013?
Yeah, well, in 2013, I think if we begin with 2013, it's important to understand there's a huge debate on race that's emerged in Cuba, a debate that's been deepening over the last few years and really has become a major aspect of the Cuban discussion about, you know, what the revolution has accomplished and what the revolution needs to improve on, actually to advance, what other issues it needs to tackle very seriously. And we had this talk, as you said, this sort of discussion. Dr. Keith Ellis, who are a very noted Cuban specialist, Professor Emeritus at York University, and myself, together with the audience. And you know, we had a discussion about what's going on in the issue of race in Cuba, some of the distortions around it, but particularly around the importance of a very important book, which I recommend, that recently came out, which I recommend to your viewers, called Race in Cuba by Esteban Morales. And it's an excellent book. He's probably the leading scholar on race in Cuba, and his book is particularly brilliant. And what he does is he looks at race in a historical context, the racism that existed in Cuba, the inequality that existed in Cuba before the revolution, what the revolution was able to do positively to tackle these issues, where the revolution itself, made mistakes in dealing with the issue of race, either through not truly understanding how endemic race and racism was within Cuban history, but also particularly and looking at what is unfolding in Cuba now to actively deal with these particular issues and so forth. And it is it's an exciting book, so I recommend that to people. When it comes to the issue of race and so forth, one of the problems, particularly for people who have been supporters of the Cuban Revolution, and I'm a supporter of the Cuban Revolution, but there are many who basically believe that, to acknowledge that the revolution itself has issues and problems, right, that are still to be resolved and in some cases were not addressed properly, is somehow to be undermining the revolution. What Cubans have said in this huge debate is that they must look critically at unresolved issues, right, and deal with this issue. Now, in my book, Cuba Revolution in Motion, I'm hopefully either going to do an update of it soon. I promised this for quite a while. I'm still writing it, but it came out in 2004. I had a chapter called Race, Revolution, and Inequality, and where I argued that the race and inequality that had heightened in Cuba because of certain measures taken in the 1990s that were unavoidable, this posed a very serious challenge. But at the same time, I argued that it's one thing to talk about a society, which is a theoretical point, to say that a society has racism in it, which no doubt Cuba does, but to make a distinction between a society that has racism in it and a racist society. And for me, the theoretical distinction is, what is the role of the state? Is the state an active promoter, generator, and sustainer of racial inequality and racist social relations? Or is the state an active intervener in very positive ways to tackle these particular issues and so forth? And the argument that Esteban Morales makes is that Cuba still has to deal with a legacy of racism in its society, still has to tackle this issue from racial inequality in a socioeconomic way, all the way up to dealing with issues when these debates over beauty standards and what's good here and bad here, these old debates that we've seen before that have come out of the debased experience of slavery and colonialism. He argues that these things exist in Cuba and have to be tackled in a very serious issues, but at the same time, the state in Cuba, through its general socioeconomic programs, but also specific, through its very specific programs to deal with racial inequality, right? Okay, is active in trying to end racism and race relations, as opposed some would make an argument to societies like in United States and Canada, where people would argue that the state itself is not a neutral arbiter and can never be an ally of ending racist oppression and racial inequality, but is also an active promoter and generator of these things. So these are some slight theoretical points. And, you know, in the course of our discussion, we can get into more specific things, like what was the condition of black Cubans before the revolution, what were the successes of the revolution, and what have been its sort of failings in dealing with this issue, and how has it addressed some of these issues as well. So some readers may know that Cuba, since 1986, has launched an affirmative, what some people might call an affirmative action program in terms of promoting blacks into positions of meaningful political leadership within the society at all levels of the state and all levels of the hierarchy of the Communist Party of Cuba and into management positions, and that this affirmative action program has been deepened over the years to encompass a whole number of other issues and so forth, and resulting in the fact that it's a very richly textured, very profound, very critical debate that's been embraced by the Cuban society and sort of is percolating through all layers of the Cuban society on the issues of how Cuba must effectively deal with this issue of racial inequality, racism, and so forth in the society, and that the Cuban government is active in taking this up as a very serious issue.
You're listening to Saturday Morning Live. My name is Norman Richmond. I'm on the line with Isaac Saini, the author of Cuba, A Revolution in Motion. Now, there is a figure by the name of Carlos Moore who is a very controversial figure, and I'm reading or about to complete a book by Marika Sherwood, and Carlos Moore grew up in Cuba.
Yeah, he grew up in Cuba and he left in the 1960s.
And he was with Malcolm X in France. He was befriended by Malcolm X, and Marika Sherwood is kind of critical. Well, a lot of people are critical of him, but he is the one that has been promoting the fact that Cuba is racist, Fidel Castro has been racist. And one of the things he said that I found to be very strange was that the Cubans sent black people to Angola because they wanted to fight in the war to get rid of black folks. But when I saw videos and films of the people that actually went to Angola, they were black, white. I think Che Guevara's daughter actually went there. And you know, Carlos Moore has been, he's very controversial. Where does he stand now in terms of this debate on...
He flip-flops back and forth. And one of the best things, before we get into this, one of the best replies to Carlos Moore, and he wrote, you know, he's written several articles, he wrote a book critical of Cuba, but there is a very good, a website called www.afrocubaweb.com, and Pedro Perez Dewey, who is a black Cuban scholar who lives in Cuba and lives outside and travels freely, and you know, he edited a collection called Afro Cuba, which looked at race and issues in Cuba and so forth. He's a supporter of the revolution, but he acknowledges that there's still a lot to be done in terms of dealing with other number of issues, including the issue of race and racism. And he wrote a very good reply to Carlos Moore on www.afrocubaweb.com. And so that's a very good piece, I think, for your readers to look at. That being said, I mean, Carlos Moore left Cuba in the 60s, and he sort of made a career out of being sort of the person who is exposing what is Cuba's hidden secret, as he would like to call it, right? Which, I mean, there's a lot of people who go around, you know, there's issue on, we won't get into discussion, there's issues, for example, on gay, lesbians, and so forth, rights in Cuba. That has been one thing that has been used to beat the revolution over the head, and people are increasingly realizing that, you know, this is another area of misinformation and disinformation about Cuba. But Carlos Moore used the issue of race. But he's flip-flopped back and forth. At one point, you know, he would, you know, his calling of Cuba a racist society, Fidel Castro racist, was taken apart by many different scholars. But what has happened is that when he began to realize that the people who would be returning to Cuba, this Miami exile community, who are overwhelmingly white and who are overwhelmingly racist, he began to realize that this would not be for the benefit of black Cubans and probably not even for his own careerist opportunities, and he began to change his tune somewhat. He changes back and forth depending on the wind, depending on, I guess, who will pay him the most and so forth. I mean, in terms of what will advance his career. So Carlos Moore, you know, is someone who has been given a lot of space and so forth by various forces in the United States and so forth. But most scholars and most Afro-Cubans reject his position. And, you know, to place this in context, when Cuba, the revolution triumphed in 1959, Cuba was an extremely racist society. There was segregation in terms of, you know, beaches that were whites only. There were clubs that whites could only enter. Even Fulgencio Batista, the dictator, was overthrown because he was mixed race, you know, what Latin Americans like to unfortunately refer to as mulattoes and so on. There were some clubs he could not enter to. When the revolution triumphed, it ended all of that racial segregation and a massive redistribution of wealth, education, healthcare, and other social programs, the agrarian reform, i.e. the land reform, the redistribution of land, the urban reform, all of these different things overwhelmingly benefited the vast majority of Cubans who were poor, and therefore, because of black Cubans were at the bottom of the society, it overwhelmingly benefited them. Within this, the professional classes, which were overwhelmingly white, which opposed all of these measures, which were empowering those who they thought should simply be their servants and who should have no role in decision-making in society, that section of that society left, about a quarter of a million left in the early 60s, overwhelmingly white and so forth. And this also opened up space in Cuban society. So, you know, Cuba had 6,000 doctors, more than half of those doctors left and so forth. So all sorts of space opened up in Cuban society. So these measures that the Cuban government adopted in terms of redistributing wealth and creating opportunities for people, combined with the fact that a lot of people who monopolized all of these professional positions of what's left, opened up a lot of space for Cubans, and therefore overwhelmingly also benefited black Cubans. And from 1959 to 1989, over that 30-year period, the kind of measures that Cuba took place in terms of raising education, raising the standards of living of people, right, on all of these distribution of wealth, dramatically lowered and the levels of inequality between black and white Cubans. But one of the things, obviously, that people need to bear in mind is that Cuba, when the revolution triumphed, was a poor, undeveloped, quote-unquote, third-world country facing all of these problems of underdevelopment and had limited resources with which to transform its society. So, for example, if you go to Cuba, anyone's been going to Cuba, will know one of the biggest issues that Cuba faces, materially and in terms of socially, is housing. Housing is a huge issue in Cuba. Now, Cuba does not have a homeless population problem. That's not an issue in Cuba, right? The issue that is a significant or there's a sizable homeless population, that doesn't exist in Cuba. And, you know, but what happens is that sometimes you have families living two and three and four generations, you know, in a dwelling and so forth, and this has created problems. And Cuba's not been able to address this adequately because when the revolution triumphed in 1959, there were all of these grandiose plans to build incredible new housings for all sorts of Cubans. And they suddenly realized, well, as a poor, underdeveloped country, they did not have the resources to do all of these different things, to provide free healthcare, free education, this immense social safety net and social programs, and at the same time build housing and do all of these different things. So they had to cut back with their limited resources and what they could do. And so housing was one of the areas that lagged behind. Also, the Cubans faced almost immediately the immense economic hostility, not to forget the terrorist attacks that have been launched from the U.S. territory, but they faced the immense economic hostility of the United States, which attempted to economically asphyxiate the country. So while tremendous advances were made materially, there were certain areas that still lagged behind in 1989. I chose 1959 to 1989, that 30-year period, which should be obvious to most people, because what happened after that was the collapse of the Soviet Union Eastern Bloc. And Cuba, which depended on 85% of its trade, export and imports from the Eastern Bloc and so forth for its oil and so forth, went into, as you know, into a massive economic crisis because all of its trading relations, all of its sources of capital, technology, and
let me clarify one thing. When we are talking about Eastern Europe, they came from the Soviet Union. After the Soviet Union, East Germany, or what? Which countries were really supporting
Soviet Union, obviously.
Right.
There were extensive relations with Eastern Europe. There were trading agreements with Poland and so forth. The so-called Eastern Bloc countries with some, I mean, I keep forgetting, you know, we grew up during that time. For some people, it's ancient history. But that's the time of what was so-called existing socialist bloc, right?
Right.
People can have debates over the nature of those societies. But they had extensive trading relations with Cuba. So Cuba got almost all of its oil from the Soviet Union. It got its markets for its products and its sources of capital and technology were all from these areas. And when these societies collapsed, they refused to acknowledge their old agreements with Cuba. No, they would have not. They acknowledged their old agreements with other countries, but due to U.S. pressure, they basically broke up these relationships with Cuba. And Cuba, you know, went into from 1990 to 1994, middle of 1994, the economy contracted by over 35%.
At that time, people predicted that Fidel was going to be overthrown right after that.
Yeah, if there are any young people, you could write an honest thesis, a master's thesis, and all these people who are still trotted out on this in the news programs as experts in Cuba. These are the same people who predicted the revolution would be gone in a couple of years and so forth. So the revolution went into a massive economic crisis, right? And Cuba was left in the 1990s trying to survive. And what happened was one of the things they did. There were two things which I'll focus on. One was basically they opened up to tourism, and two, they legalized the holding of hard currency in Cuba. I mean, they had criminalized the holding of hard currency because they didn't want people's access to housing and to all sorts of other items to be determined by how much money you had. So Cuba had to legalize hard currency, and so when they legalized the hard currency, okay, it meant that remittances, that is money coming from relatives who had left Cuba and were sending back to the relatives now living on the island, became very important. And, as I mentioned before, a massive exodus had taken place of rich white Cubans, or white Cubans, and so when money was coming back from Cuba, it was coming from white family members to white family members. And this began to increase a certain level of inequality between black Cubans and white Cubans, opening up of tourism as well in Cuba in order to get hard currency. The easiest thing it had, the most abundant resource it had was its beaches. And so it began to invest in tourism. It didn't have access to the markets. It didn't have access to the capital. It didn't have access to all of these different things. So while Cubans owned the physical infrastructure, the management of the tourist facilities, because these people had access to the tourist markets, were put in hands of a lot of European management firms, and they brought their racist practices with them, right? And so for a long time, what these firms would do, and it's famous, is they'd come in, they'd fire all the black workers, and the only time you'd find a brother or sister doing anything for a while was doing the menial work, or cleaning out the lavatories and so forth. So these became very big issues that began to introduce escalate levels of inequality within Cuban society, particularly racial inequality. When the economy stabilized in the 1990s, the government knew that significant inequality had been introduced by these measures, which were necessary to preserve education, healthcare, and all these other social achievements. But a level of inequality didn't emerge that had to be dealt with. And so the Cuban government began to basically put in place a number of very important measures to tackle racial inequality. And so it began to have a very significant focus on making sure blacks were promoted into very important positions in the political state structure and so forth. And they began to implement a number of affirmative action programs to deal with this issue of racial inequality. And then a big debate began to emerge on this whole issue. So you have conferences and discussions of black history in Cuba that's quite rich and textured, and you have a whole explosion of a discussion of how to deal with this issue of race and racial inequality that's existed in Cuba and what should be done to deal with it. So it's a huge debate supported by the Cuban government. And in fact, as was pointed out by Dr. Keith Ellis at our discussion, the Cubans are appointing a new vice president whose sole portfolio, whose sole focus will be the focus on the issue of race in Cuba and so forth. So the Cuban state began to take this extremely seriously, right, and so forth. Another interesting aspect as well is the Cubans also began to realize that race is not something that you can treat as an epiphenomena. That once, you know, you move the transition from capitalism to socialism, once you move, once you begin to deal with the issue of class relations and so forth, that race is an epiphenomena and racism is something that will disappear naturally. They began to realize that it's fundamental to the evolution of capitalism, fundamental to the development of imperialism, fundamental specifically to Cuban history, Spanish conquest, all the way up to Spanish colonialism and then U.S. domination of Cuba from 1898 to 1959, that this became very important to actually intervene in directly. So as I said before, there's a whole discussion in Cuba now about intervening directly on the issue of race and race relations within Cuba. And so it's important to understand that when we talk about racism and racial inequality in Cuba, it pales, I would argue, in comparison to racism and racial inequality that exist in North America and in Latin America. But that being said, you know, a socialist revolution cannot, in many ways, accept, right, any kind of inequality of that kind of nature. And so that's why they've decided to launch this massive campaign that's been driven by decisions from the top of the society as well as from the, what you could say, the bottom of the grassroots level.
Let me ask you, I'm speaking with Isaac Saini. Let me ask you this about Cuba's sports and the music and the film situation. Historically, let's go back to like 1968. That was like supposedly the Black Power Olympics, and you know, the Africans from the United States, I guess, took many of the medals there. 76 Olympics was the Caribbean, maybe the first Caribbean Olympics, where you had Juan Turin. I think he won the 4 and the 8. But you know, in like 68. The Cubans gave their medals to in one of the relays to Stokely Carmichael, then Stokely Carmichael, who is now Kwame Ture. How did Cuba do in the last Olympics? I think there has been a drop in the, you know, the medal count of Cuba. Am I right in saying that? Could you talk about that?
There has been, and one of the reasons is why is that what's happened is a lot of Cubans have left the island. I mean, what happens is a campaign that's launched at every Olympics, before the Olympics, at every Pan American Games, for example, by forces that are supported by the United States and by these Cuban exile communities to get Cubans to defect. And so with the lure that they will make all sorts of money and so forth. So this is part of the brain drain. And it not only affects Cuba. I mean, it's because Cuba is so politicized and so forth that people think that, you know, this is only a problem that faces Cuba, like loss of athletes, loss of professionals and so forth. But this brain drain is a problem that faces all of the South or the so-called third world. So there's lots of people, for example, and you can look at the English Olympic team, you know, lots of them are people who aren't originally from Britain. I mean, if I may use that, I mean, in a sense, they're people who, in a sense, have been purloined, right, by the so-called Western nations to participate and so forth. So, I mean, actually, what's interesting, I'm a big football fan. I'm a soccer fan, right? So I watch a lot of soccer. You know, and like if you look at some of the teams, like the Dutch team, there's the under-21 European Championship going on. If you look at these Dutch teams, for example, even the German teams, there's lots of Africans playing on them right now. These are people, you know, who in some cases, you know, may have been born there, but some people have immigrated, right, and so forth. And they've been lured away from their countries. And in fact, there's usually a big fight. And in fact, there were two brothers who were playing for Germany, they both have German ancestry, and one, you know, said that broke his relationship from Ireland with his brother because his brother refused to play for the African nation in which he was played, which he was born, right? But it's a whole debate in these whole issues, right? In some ways, it's good, for example, that, you know, in a society such as Germany, you have so many Africans who have been successful on a team and so forth, and in Holland and so forth. But the point I'm trying to make is also part and parcel of this is the fact that you have, as in Cuba, people being lured away. So this is one of the problems that Cubans have faced. You have, for example, the case of Robles, right, who is was a former gold medalist in the 110 hurdles, is one of the top people in 110 hurdles. In a sense, you know, he feels he's been lured away. He feels, you know, that his success, right, has been hurt by the Cuban system. What the Cuban system does, though...
Where is he now?
He's still in Cuba.
Right.
I don't know if he's in Cuba or out of Cuba right now, right?
Right.
But he wants to leave, right? And in fact, he left, I think, right? And the issue that really boiled down is he was lured away by the idea that he'd make more money, but also the Cuban system of sport. While people focus on these elite athletes who receive all of this training, its fundamental basis is that sport, okay, and recreation and access to recreation and these sporting activities and facilities is a fundamental right of the citizen, right? And so what happens is that these people can make much more money, right, millions of dollars more, right, if they were outside of Cuba than if they were inside Cuba, right? And so some of them sort of... fall prey to this lure. I mean, you can think of Theophilus, the late Theophilus Stevenson, the great boxer, right, who was offered millions of dollars, right, to fight Muhammad Ali, right, to abandon, as he would say, his homeland, right? And he said, you know, I have the love of 10 million Cubans. It's worth more to me than than a few million dollars, is what he said, right? He's very famous for saying that. And, you know, you have Omar Linares, the famous Cuban baseball player, probably the greatest, some people argue, arguably the greatest Cuban baseball player, who refused. You have Alberto Wantarena. So there's a whole slew of them who actually argue, for example, that they would rather, you know, serve their country and remain loyal to their country than basically abandon it in order to make millions of dollars. I mean, it's similar in a sense to what happens with Cuban doctors. You have thousands of Cuban doctors who are serving abroad all over Africa. At some point, they were serving in over 100 different countries, right? And these are doctors who aren't making big money. In a sense, they serve in the poorest communities, sometimes living and sharing the kind of privation that some of these people, the communities are going through. And there's a whole, you know, targeted program to force these doctors to defect, to say, listen, here you are, you're not making any money, you're a specialist. If you left and you were working in a capitalist society, or you would be you know, one of the most revered and people with one of the greatest status, and you'd have all these cars and houses. And only 2% of these Cuban doctors have defected, right? Because most of them remain loyal to the idea that they are fulfilling a very elemental human solidarity mission, right? That is, they're extending medical services to people who don't have it, right? And so it's, in a sense, it's akin to what happens to a lot of these sporting stars. So Cuba has lost a lot of its baseball players. It's lost quite a few of its top athletes to people who basically end up deciding that they can have a better life, materially speaking, in terms of access to much, much more money as elite athletes, by leaving Cuba and going off to some Western nation and so forth. But this is also a problem that faces other so-called other countries from the south and so forth, where their athletes, you know, leave. And some of these European athletic teams, if you look at them, you know, they're peopled by people who were lured away from their original homelands and so forth.
Let me cut you right here and talk about Nigeria. I remember Nigeria had a sprinter who was running for Portugal. They had distance people that were running for maybe Bahrain
Like, even this guy, in the last Olympics, the guy who won the middle distance. I'm trying to remember what his name was. I can't remember it right now, right?
He was a Somali?
Okay, he's all of these guys. I mean, I'm not trying to judge these people. I'm not saying that I wouldn't do the same in their position. I'm not trying to say that. But I'm trying to say that, you know, this is one of the problems that the so-called South faces. This is what is called brain drain, and the loss of athletes, right? These you know, top athletes is an aspect of that brain drain. But you have professionals. You have people, you know, I might consider myself part of that. I grew up in Trinidad and Tobago. I'm working and teaching in Canada, right? I have lots of friends, right, from the Caribbean, from Africa, right, and from other countries in Asia and so forth, who come from those countries, study here, and stay here, right? Some of them are on full scholarships from their countries and so on. And Dr. Norman Govan from Jamaica, who is now teaching at the International Institute of Race Relations in Trinidad and Tobago, has done calculations. And some people estimate, you know, the cost of the brain drain, right, to the so-called South hundreds of billions of dollars, and maybe over 50 billion, maybe close to $100 billion a year. So it becomes a very serious issue, right?
Right.
A very, very serious issue. And Cuba itself, you know, in terms of its athletes and so forth, has argued that why, for example, like what happens? An athlete leaves Cuba, defects from Cuba, goes to a country or immigrates to a country, whether it's legal or illegally, and the Cubans say, well, listen, if our society, okay, paid for your upkeep, paid for your training, right, gave you the resources so that you could focus on becoming an elite athlete, right, and then you decide to leave, right? Okay. What the Cubans often do is that somebody leaves. If I'm an athlete for country X and I go to country Y, what happens is, before I can represent country Y, there's a maximum period, a minimum period in which I am not allowed to represent that country, right? Okay. Now, what happens is that minimum period itself, okay, can be waived if the country you left basically waives and gives you permission to represent that country. And Cuba never does that, because Cuba's position, I think, is a correct one. If we, and as a society, you know, with all our problems we face from U.S. economic assault, from the fact that fact that we're trying to overcome this legacy of colonial domination and so forth and so on. If we provided all of the resources so that you could become an elite athlete, why should we therefore then just turn a blind eye and allow you to just willy-nilly leave and so forth? So these are one of the issues and so forth. So Robles, for example, the famous 110 hurdlers who's left Cuba, doesn't want to run for Cuba anymore, the Cubans have refused to basically waive that minimum period in which he has to wait before he can compete.
So that means he can leave then?
Yeah, he can leave.
Okay, let me. We're running out of time. We have about 15 minutes, but there was two issues I wanted you to deal with. One is the film industry in Cuba, and the last issue I wanted you to talk about the symposium, Africa's Unknown War: Apartheid, Terror, Cuba, and Southern African Liberation, which is going to take place in September. But the film industry in Cuba is something that I wanted to talk about. I heard a Cuban consular here as many years ago said that the Cubans were doing a film on Huey P. Newton, and that the, you know, Eldridge Cleaver, when he went to Cuba, it's another issue. Eldridge is the type of guy who Eldridge went to prison. He was in the Nation of Islam. He denounced the Nation of Islam. Then he befriended Kwame Ture. Then he blew Kwame Ture away. He went to Cuba. He blew the Cubans away. He blew everybody away with the exception,
he,
I guess.
He became a Republican, right?
Yeah, the North.
And wrote a sequel to his book, Soul on Ice, called Soul on Fire, where he became almost a born-again Christian.
Yeah, and he had those penis pants, his pants, right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the point I'm making is that they were going to make a film. The Cubans were supposed to make a film on Huey Newton. I don't know if you know anything about that, but what is the state of the Cuban film industry?
Well, I don't know anything about a film about Huey Newton, and I think I know there's a film that's supposed to be made about Toussaint Louverture, right, by the Venezuelans, but I don't know about any film by Huey Newton, right?
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I'm going to see this Monday, see a new film that's been made by the French, apparently quite a good film. I'm seeing a special screening of it on Toussaint Louverture, right? So I'm hoping to see what that's like and so forth, because that should be a very interesting film. But I don't know specifically about any film about Huey Newton, but it would be very interesting what kind of film would be made. But
well, Huey Newton, when he left Cuba, he he left on very good terms, and they wanted him to stay. But when the point I'm making about Huey Newton is he refused to. Had he denounced the Cubans, he would have been able to. He was Dr. Huey P. Newton. He probably would have still been alive today. But that's another point.
I mean, we were sounding on top of it, but you know, people need to be aware now, because you know, some people may be aware that Malcolm X's grandson was just died under mysterious circumstances in Mexico, right?
Correct.
A few weeks ago, right? And I was talking about this, you know, particularly in regards to Assata Shakur, who is an exile in Cuba, who's been granted exile and refuge in Cuba from the racist U.S. imperialist state. And I keep telling people, my position is that this state, this, you know, U.S. imperialism, these states, they don't forget, right? They have very long memories, even after people who may have made certain policies are no longer with us, have passed on, right? And these states are extremely vindictive. And I have no doubt, when you look at it, so many children, right, of black revolutionaries, right, even if these children aren't revolutionaries themselves, have been killed. And so forth. So this thing about Huey Newton, you know, people often talk about how he died and so forth. I mean, one cannot, given the history of COINTELPRO, Operation Chaos and so forth, one can't be naive and not say that the U.S. state, you know, is so vindictive that it is not eliminating people, right, even their children and so on. But we can leave that aside. I mean, as to the film industry in Cuba, right, there's a lot of very interesting films that have been made. I mean, when the economic crisis hit in the 1990s, obviously the resources to make films itself were diminished. I'm not really an expert on the film industry, but I know that there have been a number of very interesting films. And when it comes to the black experience, some very good films have been made by Gloria Rolando, right, who made a very good film on the 1912 massacre, right, which took place just over 100 years ago, in which basically you had the independent party of color which was a party representing Afro-Cubans, which were fighting against the racism and the racial marginality and the racial exclusion that existed in Cuba, particularly in the wake of the U.S. occupation of Cuba and so forth, and what happened, and then in the U.S. domination of Cuba. And she made a very good film about what happened at massacre, where at least 3,000, some say as high as 6,000 black Cubans with the complicity of the U.S. Government was massacred by Cuban forces, right? This is on the, in 1912 and so forth. And she made a very good film called Eyes on the Rainbow about Assata Shakur. So there's some very interesting films that have been made that basically look at the problems of the Cuban Revolution in fact, are very critical of what are seen as deficiencies and shortcomings of the Cuban Revolution and so on, right? I mean, I watch a lot of them, and so my experience of these films is not as an expert on the film industry in Cuba, but specifically as somebody who looks upon the films as very important pieces of work, but also very important pieces of social commentary on what the Cuban Revolution has so incredibly succeeded in giving to Cubans, but where it also has deficiencies and where it's also attempting to improve and so forth.
Okay, now, I wanted you to spend some time on this symposium, Africa's Unknown War, Apartheid, Terror, Cuba, and Southern African Liberation. Is going to take place on September 27th and 28th at the University of Toronto. And let us know what's going to be taking place.
Yeah, well, it's taking place at the University of Toronto, 27 and 28, at William Dew Auditorium, which is on 45 Wilcox Street. We have, we have an organizing committee. I'm the chair of the organizing committee, but we have the Caribbean Studies Program. Melanie Newton from the Caribbean Studies Program is part of it as well. She's a very important person in the committee. We have Miguel San Vicente, who owns a different book list. He's involved, and we have a number of other different people. And what it's about, it's twofold. It's one about discussing what is a recent part of African history and human history that has been ignored. The fact that this the South African racist state waged a war of terror from about 1975 to 1988, which killed hundreds of thousands of people across the region and causing billions of dollars of worth of damage. And this has been forgotten, right, and not talked about, right? So, and if anyone who has read the truth and read the report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, they devote an entire volume to what they call the South African state beyond its borders, which is this war of terror, and they acknowledge that more people died outside the borders of South Africa in the anti-apartheid struggle than died inside. So that's one thing. And part and parcel of this is also the Cuban contribution to defeating this war of terror. And the Cubans, had from the very moment the Cuban Revolution triumphed in 1959, Cuba supported national liberation struggles across the world, particularly those national liberation and anti-colonial struggles in Africa. And so there's very close relations with these African liberation struggles. And Cuba developed a very close relationship with the liberation movement in Angola. What happened was that when South Africa invaded Angola, just as it was about to declare and consolidate its independence from Portuguese control, and it's important to understand the Portuguese waged a vicious struggle to maintain its control over its African colonies, that when the Portuguese were giving up their colonies for a number of reasons and so forth, but mainly because there had been a successful liberation struggle in Mozambique, in Guinea-Bissau, in Cape Verde, and in Angola by African revolutionaries. Just as this independent black African state was about to establish itself, the South African racist state invaded it. And the Angolans issued, under the Movement for the Popular Liberation of Angola, which was the main liberation movement and the one that was most broadly based, when they issued an SOS, a call for help, some countries did respond, but Cuba was the only one to respond massively and in any way significant and relevant help. Over 36,000 Cuban troops were sent, and what happened was the South Africans were beaten in Angola, and in 1976 were forced to withdraw. And this was the first defeat of the invincible white army. And in fact, you can read newspapers and so forth that talk about that this is the first time that the so-called psychological mystique that the white South Africans were invincible had been broken, right? And in fact, at the Soweto uprising in June of 1976, some of the youth carried placards saying, if it happened in Angola, it can happen here. That is, if the white South Africans can be beaten in Angola, why can they not be beaten in South Africa? So this is very, very important, right? Because South Africa wanted to establish, its regional hegemony, okay? It wanted to basically ensure that the state itself could extend its criminal existence by controlling the region, and therefore that's why it's waged this war of terror, often referred to as a war of destabilization. Cuba stayed in Angola from 1975 up until the early 1990s, but what happened was all of these things reached a climax. This war reached a climax in 1987-88 at a series of battles in southern Angola, particularly around a town called Quito Cuanaval, where the South African armed forces were defeated, developed a very serious military setback, and this altered the balance of power in the region, right, and accelerated the end of apartheid. So what this symposium is about telling the story. And we have people coming up from South Africa, from Cuba, from Angola. We have the South African, Cuban, Angolan embassies participating. We're probably going to have people from the United Nations missions of these different countries participating as well. So it's expected to be a large, very large symposium with very important papers delivered. We're also probably going to show a film the Friday evening before the Saturday of the convention, of Cuban film, possibly Kagamba, which is a very, very magnificent, and we're talking about Cuban film, but it's a very good Cuban drama about based on an actual battle and memoirs, actual battle that took place in 1983, and so on. So the point about this is to recover this unknown history. One, this history about what is really, I don't want to use the word, a mini African Holocaust in the sense of what the South African state waged, and the hundreds of thousands of people that are killed during that period of time, directly or indirectly, but also the unknown story of Cuba's decisive role in defeating apartheid. And some of your readers may know that the first country that Nelson Mandela chose to visit outside of Africa was Cuba. Okay, and he continually extolled Cuba's contribution to the struggle against racist rule in South Africa. I encourage your readers to go to Google, and in YouTube or on YouTube, put in Nelson Mandela and Fidel Castro, and what will come up is a 5-minute excerpt from the where it shows Nelson Mandela meeting with Fidel, and it talks a lot about Cuba's role in supporting African liberation struggles. And you'll see the close relationship that Nelson Mandela had with Fidel Castro. When Nelson Mandela was inaugurated as president of South Africa, of first democratic South Africa, first president in elections are opened up to everyone, when he was elected in 1994 at his inauguration, when, you know, after he's giving his speech and so forth, and people are, you know, coming up, all the guests and so forth, you know, heads of state and so forth are coming up to shake his hands. If you look at the footage, Mandela jumps out of the position, and when Fidel Castro comes and gives Fidel Castro a huge bear hug and says very audibly, "You made this day possible," and so forth. So this is part and parcel of what we're going to do at the symposium. It's going to be exciting. We're going to have some very important guests, some of the top scholars in this, but also some people who participated in these events from South Africa, from Angola, from Cuba, and so forth. So it should be a very exciting time.
Let me say this. You could comment on this, but it's my understanding that when America had the American Revolution, they called on people to help them. And one of the people who actually came to help the Americans was Christoph. Christoph came to, I think it was Savannah, Georgia. And but, you know, the American government tried to say that, you know, they got this communist support from Cuba, as if that was something that was a new phenomenon, where historically people have called on other people to help them in other revolutions. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, and people have often, because, I mean, like, you know, Toussaint Louverture lent material and intellectual, right, help to Simon Bolivar, right? People have forgotten that Simon Bolivar spent some time in Haiti, and the Haitian revolutionary supported him, right, and provided him all sorts of assistance. I mean, even in terms of national liberation, look what, if you look at World War II, what were the American and French and British troops doing in France and so on, right? So it's nothing if a sovereign people who are throwing off the colonial look, you know, and face an invasion from another racist colonial power, which is what South Africa really was intending to be, call for assistance, that's recognized. And it was there, right? And people all throughout Africa recognized that what this what the Cubans were doing was basically responding to an urgent call, an urgent plea for help from the Angolans and so forth. And even the United States knew this. I mean, for example, as early as 1976, there's an article in the New York Times. I mean, you know, the U.S. liked to always say that the Cubans were acting as puppets of the Soviet Union. But the U.S. knew that Cuba had taken this decision without consulting the Soviet Union.
Right.
And, in fact, independent of it, right, and in response to the South African invasion. And there was an article in the New York Times in 1976 where, you know, basically it was said, it was published that basically the state, U.S. State Department knew that, you know, Cubans had acted independently and on their own, but the U.S. would deny this specifically because this fake story that the Cubans were acting as puppets of the Soviet Union served the U.S. purposes, right? And they decided, in a sense, to ensure that this was the kind of story that's propagated, even though they knew the Cubans had acted independently of the Soviets and on their own, and in response to an urgent, desperate plea by the Angolans for help to repel the racist invasion from South Africa.
All right. It is, we have 4 minutes, but I wanted to just let you sum up, and because we want to get out of here before 1 o'clock, and I don't want to let you go back to watch your football, real football, in terms of where they kick a ball as opposed to throw a ball.
But I'm a big fan of football. I'm going to watch the Brazil-Japan game in the Confederations Cup. But besides, football is very interesting politically to look at it. Right? There's a whole discussion we can have on that, especially commentary and so forth, like, you know, how African countries are portrayed and so forth. But that's another long discussion.
No, you're right.
What I like to focus on is basically I think people should buy Esteban Morales' book, Race in Cuba. It's published by Monthly Review, and you can get it at a different book list. It's a very, very powerful, very important read, and I think it's very important for people who are interested in the issue of racism and the struggle for justice, right, and so forth, that this book is essential reading. Second point is I hope people will come to the symposium. We'll have, I know it's a way off yet, 27th and 28th. It's free for everyone. And I'm sure people will go away with an understanding not only of this aspect of African history, of which Cuba is part, because Cuban history is part of the history of the African diaspora. It's part of the history of the Black Atlantic. Among other histories, it's also part of. And appreciate what this small country was able to do. I mean, in a time when we have interventions being talked about all over the world, right, and so forth, what Cuba represents in terms of the help it gave the Angolans is it demonstrates that, you know, a country's foreign policy does not have to be generated by real politics, by whether it gains or not, right, by whether there's some material benefit for it or not, or some geopolitical gain. What it demonstrates is that international human solidarity based on true human love and true human devotion to justice and peace really can exist in this world. And Cuba, in a sense, whatever its imperfections, is an example that another better world is possible. And in the case of Angola, we'll see how Cuba made a very important contribution to a struggle against terrorism, which is this regional war of terror that the racist South African apartheid state waged and so forth. So I think it'll be a story that opens people's eyes, informs them about a piece of history that has been covered up, but also I think inspires them that it is possible that human beings to live in a society based on genuine human solidarity.
I thank you very much, and I wanted to just say that not only did Martin Luther King talk about a revolution being based on love, it also was said by Ernesto Che Guevara, basically made the same point.
Yeah, he said, let's, you know, at the risk of sounding, I guess it was foolish, he said, like, you know, a true revolutionary must have love in his heart, or something to that effect.
Something to that effect. All right. So we'll definitely bring you back, my friend. Thank you very much for...
Well, thank you for having me, Norman. It's always a pleasure. And it's always good being on a show that I think is doing very important work.
Thank you very much.
Okay. All the best.
All right. And we have been speaking with Isaac Saini, author of A Revolution in Motion. And we are signing off. This has been Radio Regent's Saturday Morning Live.
Cowboys and girls. I remember when I used to play Bye.
got no shame. That is why I finish with this poker game.
Now, while the three Calypsonians get ready for a little dramatization, change their costumes, we're going to cast the light on the band. First, I'd like to introduce the band to you. It's Gerald Clark and his Invaders. First, High Clark on the double bass in the back. Victor Pachuco on the fiddle, the violin. Gerald Clark, the leader on the guitar. Albert Morris on the piano. And Gregory Felix, the man who's playing all of that clarinet. I hope you realize that when we get just a little bit mixed up and at cross purposes here, that this is all done pretty much on the spur of the moment. And there's a lot of improvising going on both by the singers and the band. Now we're going to hear the band play a number of its own, a number called, For Some Reason, I'm a Better Woman Than You. You ready? I'm a Better Woman Than You. Our actors are still struggling into their costumes. So just to pass the time away a minute, let's have a drum solo. DeLeon, come on out here. DeLeon, let's have a little drumming. DeLeon and Simeon are going to play some drums for you. Spotlight on them. Thank you. And now we're going to have a little Calypsonian drama. The title of the drama is The G.I. and the Lady. The G.I. is played by the Duke of Iron. The native Trinidadian is played by the Lord Invader, who is the composer, director, and producer of the piece. And I'll leave you to guess who plays the lady. Let our little drama begin.
I only hope you'll accept my apology. Amelie, baby, I only hope you'll accept my apology. I was kind of mad the other night. I must admit that my action was not right. But Millie, you know, it's only jealousy that caused me to act so disorderly. Millie, you know I love you sincerely. I beg you, honeybee, please give a chance to me. I must need tell you something. Yesterday, I went and buy the wedding ring. And Millie, I want you now to know I will entirely finish with Calypso. Millie, baby, say you love me sincerely. Next week, we will join in matrimony.
You can say what you like, I don't want to hear, because you ain't working nowhere. Because you saw me talking with this G.I. You came and then you block up both of me eyes. You bust up me nose and tear down me clothes. Then you give me so much body blows. Listen, my boy, what I'm saying to you. Tonight I am definitely true.
I went to the council to fix a date, and next week we will be leaving for the United States. Isn't that nice? I have my home in Brooklyn, a servant, a Cadillac car, and everything. So please make up your mind, baby, and tell me if you're leaving with me.